Daniel, Chapter 1, the third talk in a series on Daniel, was presented by David Crabtree on May 3, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Virtual Reformation Fellowship. We're going to be looking at the Book of Daniel this week. 2 weeks ago, I began my 2 weeks of introductory material. The first week, I talked about the basic message of the prophets. And then last week, I talked about the Tower of Babel, because I think that we are to understand the Tower of Babel as being the predecessor of empire. And empire is what the Book of Daniel is talking about. So this week, I'm determined to get into the actual text of Daniel. But Bob and Debbie sent a question during the week after I had written my outline for the chapter. And it's a good question. And I started thinking about it. And I started thinking, well, it'd be good for me to talk about a number of related issues because they're so significant for the text of Daniel. The question that Bob and Debbie sent in is a difficult one for two reasons. One is it's something that I have thought about, have been thinking about, but my thoughts have not completely congealed, and there are a lot of aspects to it. So that makes it difficult. But I think that it'll be helpful if I make some of my thinking more explicit for understanding what's going on in Daniel, at least the way that I am seeing it. The other thing that makes it difficult is it gets into the territory of, or it gets close to at least, the territory of politics. And in our day and age, it's difficult to talk about anything that's at all political. So there's the possibility that what I would say would be offensive to some. I don't intend it to be offensive. I'm just trying to explain my thoughts with respect to this issue. My intent is actually to just be clear on what it is that I'm thinking. And then as we go along, you'll see how it plays into the book of Daniel. So let me read the question, and then I'll make my comments. During the question and answer period, you responded to a question with some comments which both Debbie and I are puzzled by. You characterized as hubristic such ideas as emphasis on unity, globalization, and efforts to solve the world's problems through cooperation between different peoples. It struck both Debbie and me that all of these ideas and efforts are not only good, but essential in the context of today's internet. Qualify your statements, then perhaps we can have a conversation. So this is my attempt to clarify and qualify my statements in response to that question last week. I want to begin by highlighting some points from the Tower of Babel. Two of these are points that I know that I made, but I think it would be helpful to highlight them. The first one is that not all unified efforts that are undertaken by human beings are hubristic. To work cooperatively is part of being human. We are social animals. We want to be in groups. We want to work together. When we do work together, we are more productive and it's more fun. So it's a good thing. When this issue comes up in my mind, I always think of an Amish house raising. To build a house cooperatively, people coming together cooperatively, building a house in one day, that's a pretty amazing thing. And to have fun while doing it, that's doubly amazing. So not all efforts to work together towards a common goal are hubristic, not at all. The second thing with respect to the Tower of Babel story, in the text, it says, they said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. I never really thought about this before the last few weeks, but what's happening here, come, let us make bricks. So they're urging one another, encouraging one another to cooperate in this activity. And it says, and bake them thoroughly, which is very interesting. So it's asking people to not cut corners, to do what they're doing diligently and conscientiously. Any cooperative effort needs the buy-in of the participants. That's always true. The Amish building a house, they need the buy-in of the people that are doing it. But the grander the objective, the greater the need for total cooperation. So hubristic ventures, which seek to achieve godlike goals, they generate and have to generate more pressure for absolute cooperation and diligence. So the pressure becomes huge in those cases. The third thing I want to highlight from the Tower of Babel story, they failed to achieve the goals that they set out to achieve. Not only did they fail to achieve those goals, but they attained the opposite of those goals. They wanted a tower and a city. They got no tower. They got no city. They wanted to make a name for themselves and become famous, but they became infamous. They wanted to keep from being scattered, but they were scattered. So everything was turned on its head, and they failed. I have mentioned this this book before. I'll mention it briefly. I won't go into much detail, but there's a book that I found very interesting, very significant in my thinking. It's called Why Things Bite Back. And the subtitle is The Unintended Consequences of Technological Innovation. And it's on one of the shelves back here somewhere. I'm just going to use one example from the book, and it's the example that really caught my interest when I was reading the book. Is one about boxing gloves. And he points out that boxing gloves were an innovation that was developed because they used to box with bare knuckles. And when they boxed with bare knuckles, they would hit hard, hit the other person in the face hard, gash their face eventually, and then it'd get all bloody. There'd be blood all over the place. And so the sport looked brutal and inhumane. And they wanted to change that. So they made gloves that would go on each boxer's hands so that when they hit, it wouldn't cause all of that gushing blood. It was sometime later that what they recognized is that those gloves don't cause less damage, it just caused damage of a different sort. Instead of superficial cuts on the face that bleed, it caused brain damage. Because if you are boxing without gloves on and you hit as hard as you can, the likelihood is you will break some bones in your arm, in your fist, and then you won't be able to punch anymore the rest of the boxing match. So people always pulled their punches. But you put a glove on, and now you don't have to worry about that. You aren't going to break the bones in your fist. You can hit as hard as you can possibly hit. And that's what causes the brain damage. So this is just one example of many examples that he has in the book where people come up with a technological innovation that's going to solve a problem. But in more times than not, the great innovations that people come up with not only don't solve the problem, but they make it worse. And I think that's the kind of dynamic that's visible in the story of the Tower of Babel. And as I pointed out, God's response to hubristic ventures appears to be to guarantee that they fail. But sooner or later, they're going to fail. Okay, how can we tell when a united effort is hubristic? And I've thought about this. It is difficult. It really is difficult, at least for me. Difficult to sort it out. It is more apparent when any kind of hubristic undertaking becomes fully developed. And as they grow and become fully developed, it seems to me that it's easier to tell whether there is genuine hubris behind it all. And I don't know whether some of these united efforts, just as they develop, become hubristic, or whether it's better to think of it in terms of there's hubris involved at the very beginning, and as it grows, it becomes more manifest. And I don't know which of those is really the better way to think about it. But a quote that comes to mind when I think about this issue is a quote that I found in a book called The Birth of the Modern by Paul Johnson. And it's a quote, as I recall, I tried to find it and I couldn't find the quote because I read the book back when I was stupid and thought that there was something wrong with writing in books. I have since become smarter, and I mark up my books so that I can go back and find quotes like this. But back then, I was more stupid. Anyway, I couldn't find it, but as I recall, the context was one in which some farmers who had been experiencing more than 1 year in a row of drought conditions came to President Grover Cleveland, and they said, "President, you got to do something to help us. The government has to come to our aid because we're really hurting out there." And President Cleveland's response was, "You don't need government. You need theology." That sounds like the coldest-hearted response that one could possibly make. And yet, I suspect that there is truth in what he had said. It is not immediately obvious that there is any hubris involved in having the government help out farmers who are suffering from multiple years of drought. But as the undertaking becomes bigger, it seems to me that it's more likely to become manifestly hubristic. The bigger an undertaking, the more likely it is to be hubristic. And therefore, most hubristic undertakings involve the sin. It also seems to be the case that the bigger an undertaking, the more likely that it will attract corrupt leadership. That both of those things seem to happen. Now, I settle on a couple of examples of hubristic undertakings that I'll just talk about and hopefully give you a better idea of what I have in mind when I say a hubristic undertaking. Exhibit A is the war on poverty. Now, there are few causes that seem more unquestionably good than this, and especially for Christians, because the Bible commands us to care for the poor. And as one who has spent a lot of time reading the Old Testament, it's one of the most common themes in the Old Testament, especially in the prophetic writings. And from the perspective of the prophets, how a society cares for the poor is a major barometer of a society's spiritual well-being. So all of that would suggest that sparing no resources in helping the poor would be a good thing. However, our experience with that, with the state fighting poverty or eliminating poverty, is that we have spent billions and billions of dollars on that effort, and we are no closer to eliminating poverty than we were when we started. Why? Because it's a hubristic undertaking. And God has and will guarantee in the future that that will fail. Another way of addressing that question, why, is because it seems to me that Huber sees the problem of poverty as being a problem of inequitable distribution of money. And that has been, it seems to me, at the heart of most efforts to address poverty. Not all efforts by the state have been this, but that has been at the heart of it. And this kind of approach by the state, it promotes a kind of cold disinterestedness on the part of the citizenry. Because it's too easy to think that taking care of poverty is the government's job. And it's not my job as an individual. And yet I think that that is the biblical perspective, is that poverty in our midst is something that individuals need to respond to. And a statist approach to solving the problem of poverty tends to treat those who are poor as numbers rather than as human beings, individuals, with their own unique set of problems that are poor and in need of assistance. It seems to me that poor people actually serve a purpose in our society. They should evoke compassion and charity from individuals. And as a result, the way that poverty needs to be addressed is individuals helping poor people rather than a united effort to eliminate poverty, because the latter is doomed to failure. It's important, it is critical in dealing in helping the poor, that it is that they are being treated with compassion and respect. And ultimately, that can only be done by individuals. The state is not good at doing that. That was Exhibit A. Let me give Exhibit B. There's a lot of talk about nationalized health care. And you would think, well, isn't that also a very good cause? Isn't free health care for all a good thing? And isn't this a corollary of loving our neighbor? Well, there is a sense in which taking care of the sick is indeed something that we are called to. It's an obligation that we have. And there's a sense in which it is a corollary of loving our neighbor. But I would argue that the state is incapable of providing compassionate and sacrificial care for those who are sick and in need of help. And I won't take time to defend that now, but I believe that to be true. A nationalized healthcare system is ultimately a centralized system of healthcare rationing. It can't be otherwise. There are limited resources in any society, limited resources for taking care of the sick, and there is a huge demand. And if it's free, then it becomes even larger than it otherwise would be. As a result, in a national healthcare rationing system, only essential services can be provided because there aren't enough resources to address all healthcare needs. Who will decide what's essential? It'll be the decision makers in the system. We've seen that in the coronavirus response, that it is the governors, et cetera, that are deciding what are essential services. And you can decide for yourself how well they've done at that. In that kind of rationing system, it's easy to foresee some things that would be coming down the pike. One thing is any individuals who are risk takers, they'll be denied services. If you're a smoker, you'll be denied service. Sooner or later, one way or another, you'll be denied service. Skydivers, denied service. Rock climbers, denied service. It's just too risky. You taking risks costs all of us, And therefore, we have the right to tell you what you can do and what you can't do. Secondly, another foreseeable result is unapproved medical practices will be forbidden. So alternative health care, that'll have to be forbidden. In fact, Germany has nationalized health care, and their doctors have a book that tells them how to treat each individual sickness or whatever. And the doctors have to follow that, because otherwise people wouldn't be treated fairly, is the thinking behind it. So there would be an approved way of addressing any kind of healthcare need, and unapproved approaches would not be acceptable. And the thing that I have long thought, is ever since Seth was born, is that in this kind of system where healthcare has to be rationed by the government, a centralized rationing system of healthcare needs, defective fetuses will be euthanized. There'll be huge pressure put on people to terminate the births of anyone, any fetus that is deemed to have any significant defect. And if they aren't terminated, my guess is what would happen is the government will say, well, then you pay for all healthcare needs. Whereas other practices which are deemed essential, and I would suspect that things like sex change operations would fall into the essential category. And there are other things, abortions would fit into the essential category, that those would take priority in the rationing process. Hubris tends to see the solution to every problem as getting everyone to behave rightly. That is to say that everybody needs to do what the authorities deem to be the right thing to do. And if everybody were to do that conscientiously and consistently, it would solve our problems. And things would be heavenly if everyone would do what they're supposed to do. Therefore, to the extent that things don't turn out heavenly, then hubris looks at the population and says, well, they aren't doing it right. They aren't all being conscientious and doing what they've been told to do. We've got to get them to do what they're supposed to be doing. And they crank up the pressure one way or another. So hubris, it evolves in the direction of totalitarianism. And I'm using totalitarianism in the technical sense, that is, involved in every aspect of citizens' lives. But in order to do that, it takes on the character that's usually associated with the term totalitarianism, and that is, it becomes brutal and oppressive. Okay, so that's kind of a quick survey of my thinking with respect to the Tower of Babel, and that as an example of a hubristic human undertaking and how God relates to that. And what we'll see is that empire fits into the category of a hubristic human undertaking. And we'll see that God deals with it the same way that he dealt with the Tower of Babel. He's going to guarantee that it fails ultimately. Okay, we will be touching on different aspects of this as we go through Daniel, so I won't talk about this anymore now. But if you have questions or comments, please send them to me. And if it seems appropriate, then I might devote a whole session to addressing those questions and comments. And maybe we could figure out a way to have more of a dialogue about that. But I don't want to open up for questions right now, because I do want to get into Daniel 1. Okay, so Daniel 1. The first chapter is kind of a self-contained unit. It introduces the book, and in the last chapter, the last verse of the chapter, I think, sets it off as kind of a separate unit. Because it says, And Daniel continued there until the first year of King Cyrus. So it's talking about the beginning of Daniel's career, and then it points out that he stayed in that career all the way through until the time of Cyrus. So it's kind of a separate unit. However, it introduces the book. So it's an introduction of the book, but a separate unit, a separate part of the book. It is written in Hebrew. I pointed out 2 weeks ago that it appears to me that when it's written, the parts that are written in Hebrew are addressed primarily to a Jewish audience. And the parts that are written in Aramaic are addressed primarily to a Gentile audience. That's not to say exclusively to a Jewish audience or a Gentile audience, but primarily to that. This chapter was written in Hebrew. It is primarily addressed to a Jewish audience. It helps us to see who Daniel was, how he got his position within the Babylonian state, and what kind of person he was. So that's in that sense that it serves as an introduction to the book. And the rest of the book will tell us about the events and the divine revelations that came to Daniel while he served in the court. Okay, Daniel 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. These he brought to the land of Shinar and placed the vessels in the treasury of his gods. Daniel was taken in the first deportation, the first group, I'll call it the first deportation. Daniel was taken to Babylon in the first deportation in 605 BC. That is the third year of King Jehoiakim, who ruled from 608 to 598. Jehoiakim was the son of Josiah, King Josiah of Judah. Josiah reigned from 640 to 609. He was a very good king. 2 Kings talks about him in glowing terms. He did much that was good, carried out extensive religious reforms, getting rid of idols and tearing down the high places and that sort of thing. During his realm, a scroll was found in the temple. When they were he wanted workers to repair the temple. And while they were doing so, they found a scroll, a long-lost scroll in the temple. It would appear that that scroll had written on it the book of Deuteronomy. Josiah read that and was pierced to the heart with what he had read in thinking about what had been said to the people of Judah, of Israel, what they had agreed to, and where they had not done what they had agreed to do. And so he wanted to implement all of the commandments that were issued to the people of Israel. He wanted to implement those in the kingdom of Judah during his reign. One of the things that they did was to celebrate the Passover in earnest during his reign. And that had not been done ever. Josiah, unfortunately, was killed fighting the Egyptians in 609. It's at that point that Jehoiakim became king, his son. And Jehoiakim was not a good king. He was a bad king. So that's the setting, the time setting in which this is chapter one is occurring. It says that Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. Well, after the Battle of Carchemish, where he defeated the Assyrians and the Egyptians, what remained of the army, it retreated into Egypt. So Nebuchadnezzar had free reign in Palestine and Phoenicia. We have no record of him laying siege to Jerusalem other than this comment in Daniel. But it could very well be that he either besieged Jerusalem or threatened to do so. It was apparently, if it was besieged, the siege didn't last long. It didn't take long for Judah to capitulate, for Jehoiakim to capitulate, which makes sense because the only people that the people of Judah could have turned to for help would have been the Egyptians, and they had just been soundly defeated by the Babylonians and retreated out of the area. In any case, in 605, Jerusalem was brought to its knees. And it's apparently at that time that Jehoiakim paid to Nebuchadnezzar tribute from the storehouses of the temple. The text makes it clear that God gave Jehoiakim and the vessels into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. This is not a something where Yahweh had been defeated and conquered, but rather it was God's choosing that Nebuchadnezzar take control, defeat Jerusalem, bring Jerusalem to its knees, and make off with these vessels from the temple. So he takes vessels from the temple. And it says in the text, he took him to Shinar, and I pointed out the significance of that, that I think that is intended to remind the reader of the connection between Babylon and the Tower of Babel in Shinar. Nebuchadnezzar took these vessels from the temple, and he put them in the temple of his god, Marduk. And in the thinking of the ancient Near East, that would say that Marduk is superior to Yahweh. Now these vessels are very important. They must be, because twice in Daniel 2, that the vessels are mentioned. They also show up in Daniel 5:2 in the story of Belshazzar, and we'll get to that, but that's where the ruler of Babylon has them bring out the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem so that he could drink from them in his party. It's a huge act of hubris on the part of Belshazzar. Then the vessels also show up in Ezra 1:7, and they are specifically mentioned as something that returned with the first group of returnees from Babylon to Jerusalem. It's hard to know. God said that his people would be sent to Babylon for 70 years, that they would be in exile in Babylon for 70 years. It's hard to know when do you start the clock on that 70 years and when do you end the clock on that. Do you start with the first deportation? Do you start with the second deportation? Do you start with the destruction of the temple? Do you start with the destruction of Jerusalem? Well, I'm suspicious that the way that the Bible wants to start the clock on that is when the temple vessels were removed and taken into custody in Babylon. Because we have a verse that specifically says they were returned from Babylon, and that's in Ezra 1:7. And if you calculate the time from 605, when Daniel and the vessels from the temple go to Babylon, and when the vessels come back from Babylon, it's 72 years approximately, give or take a year. So my suspicion is that those vessels are the indicator of when Judah is in exile in Babylon. So they're very significant items, I think, in the text. It does not make explicit here that Daniel and his friends were taken at this time, but I think that's the clear implication, especially as we go on in the text. And this is a fulfillment of a prophecy. Golden Gay says, not long after an Assyrian chief of staff went to Jerusalem, Isaiah told Hezekiah that his own sons would end up as eunuchs, members of the palace staff in Babylon. Now that prophecy was fulfilled, and we'll see when we read on that in this next section it says specifically that he brought that the candidates for the training program that Daniel was a part of were Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility. In other words, sons of Hezekiah. Okay. What does this event bring to mind in the people of Judah? This event, by this event, I mean people being taken away from Jerusalem, people and the vessels being taken to Babylon. It had to have been a huge shock. And I don't know if we can fully appreciate it. I think we would have to have been immersed in the culture and the time to really appreciate what a big deal this is. Over a period of 18 years, Judah was completely dismantled. And that's when the three waves of deportations took place. Tens of thousands of people were taken to Babylon. The temple vessels were taken. The temple was destroyed. Jerusalem's walls were torn down. It transformed the world of the Jews and did a number on their brains as to how to process all of this that has happened. How could it happen? And what does it mean for us? As I pointed out 2 weeks ago, I will go through this very quickly. As I pointed out 2 weeks ago, in the ancient Near East, they would have understood the Babylonian rise to power to mean that Marduk was superior to Yahweh. Because what happens on the earth reflects what happens in the heavenlies. So Marduk must have beat up on Yahweh big time in order for Babylon to have such an easy victory against the kingdom of Judah. That would suggest that Yahweh is unable to really protect Judah. He couldn't. And he couldn't protect the temple and his holy vessels. So God, Yahweh, is a weak God. But from the perspective of the prophets, they say, don't read it that way. Yahweh warned that this would happen. They warned that this disaster was going to come. But from the perspective of the ancient Near East, that would have been a hard thing to accept as true. They didn't have the concept of a God allowing his people to be punished through the conquest of another kingdom. And furthermore, there were false prophets in Judah who were saying that Yahweh would not allow Judah to be conquered. So the people of Judah had to be at least struggling to understand what had happened and how to make sense of it. Okay, this situation had to have raised a number of new and critical questions that they may have never thought about before. The first is Yahweh really the one true God? The creator God, the transcendent creator God. Is he still committed to his people? Is he still with us? God with us, Emmanuel, is he still with us like he was in the tabernacle in the desert of Sinai? Does he still listen to us when we appeal to him and take our appeals seriously? And how do we serve God now? We knew what to do when we were back in Jerusalem at the temple. Now how do we serve God? And it's a little bit later after 605, it's a few years downstream, but there won't even be a temple. There won't be anybody offering sacrifices at the temple at that point. And then the question is really raised, how do we serve God in these circumstances? Okay, so those and other questions have to be bouncing around in the heads of Daniel and his friends. Verses 3 through 7. Then the king commanded his palace master, Ashpenaz, to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years, so that at the end of that time, they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. So Nebuchadnezzar ordered Ashpenaz, the palace master, to select and educate young Judean men. Now Ashpenaz was the overseer of all of the king's officials, apparently, and over the king's harem. So he's a very high-ranking official. He's the one who's supposed to select the candidates for this training program that Nebuchadnezzar has set up to train people to enter into service of the state. This is apparently an ongoing program. They take talented young men who were selected to be trained for the state service. I don't know if all of these are foreigners that go into this training program, or whether it's a mixture of foreigners and Babylonians. I know at later times in history, some courts preferred to have servitors, officials, that were foreigners because they were less prone to being connected in the local politics and were more likely to be faithful to the king. I don't know in this case whether there were Babylonians involved in this training program or if it's all foreigners. It's at least some young men from Judah. There could be also young men from other areas that had been conquered by the Babylonians and men that they had brought back to Babylon to serve in this way. The terms that are used to indicate what kinds of men to select have religious and ethical connotations. So they're ritually pure as well as being good candidates for this education system. We know that Persia, a little bit later, Persia had a training program for young people to enter into state service. And in all likelihood, this was a predecessor to what the Persians did. And if it is, then it probably had worked in a similar fashion. We know that the Persian system took young men at the age of 14 and the training was completed by 17, so a 3-year program like we have here, and the young men taken it for age 14. If that's true, then Daniel would have been 14 in 605, which puts him about born in about 619, which is a nice date to have in hand. The training that they received was training in the language and literature of Babylon. We know that during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, there was a renaissance of culture, and with the emphasis on ancient Babylonian language and literature. As I mentioned a couple weeks ago, Babylon went way back in history. Back into the 1800s when Hammurabi was the king. And at that time, Babylon was the biggest kingdom around. It was powerful. And it was very cultured. There were a lot of writings that were generated at that time. And they collected writings from some of the surrounding peoples. And those were passed down. And they were passed down through the other dominant peoples of the region, including the Assyrians, and they made their way to the Neo-Babylonian kingdom, and those were studied diligently by scholars during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. So Ashpenaz was told to train these young men in the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Baldwin says the accumulated literature included omens, magic incantations, prayers and hymns, myths and legends, scientific formulae for skills such as glassmaking, mathematics, and astrology. It's a 3-year program. It's preparation for service of the king. It is a broad-based education rather than narrow specialization. And some people that I know are partial to that kind of education. Students were to be given special food. It was the king's choice food, and it was the wine that the king drank. And we'll come back to this. There were 4 Judeans that were entered into this program. Daniel, whose name in Hebrew means God is my judge. Hananiah, whose name means Yah or Yahweh has been gracious. Mishael, whose name means who is what God is. And Azariah, whose name means Yah has helped or Yahweh has helped. So those were their names given to them at birth. When they enter into this program, they are given Chaldean names. And the names that they received were, Daniel got Belteshazzar, which means Bel, protect the king, and Bel was the wife of Marduk. Shadrach means, I am very fearful of God. Meshach means, I am of little account. And Abednego means servant of the Shining One. Verses 8 through 13. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine. So he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your own age, you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel asked the guard, whom the palace master had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. You can then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men who eat the royal rations and deal with your servants according to what you observe. Okay, Daniel is resolved that he is not going to eat the king's food nor drink the wine. Now, there's an unusual word that's used, and apparently it is an Aramaic term, patbag. And it's thought to be a technical term referring to the king's private reserves, his private stocks. Daniel has decided that he does not want to defile himself by eating from the king's private stocks. And we'll talk more about what I think is happening there in just a minute. Interestingly, Daniel didn't rebel. He's very respectful. Instead of just going on a hunger strike or something, he sought permission from the chief official, from the palace master, Ashpenaz. And Ashpenaz was favorably disposed to Daniel. Daniel probably knew that. The text points out that the fact that he was favorably disposed to Daniel was an act of God. It's an act of God on his behalf that's similar to what God did for Joseph in making him favored by his captors, and Esther making her favored by the king. And there are other examples of that sort of thing. What we see is favor of a foreigner in an otherwise hostile environment that God produces in order to provide a certain amount of buffering or sheltering for his people. And we'll see that Daniel is generally well-liked for those that he serves, and that goes through the whole book of Daniel. It's very interesting. He's very well-liked. the palace master didn't want to consent to Daniel's request because he was afraid it would anger the king. He's afraid that it'll be obvious to the king. Daniel's going to look less healthy, and Ashpenaz would be at great risk. His life, in fact, would be at risk. And we'll see in the next chapter that Nebuchadnezzar is capable of severe punishment for those who don't do what he asks them to do. So Daniel turns to the guard. So the guard is under the palace master. He turns to the guard and he asks the guard if the guard would be willing to consent to this arrangement that Daniel has dreamed up. And the arrangement is this kind of experiment that for 10 days they will eat vegetables and water. So no meat and no wine, apparently. So for 10 days they're going to eat this restricted diet. And the guard can stand judge over whether they look less healthy than their cohort. And if they look less healthy, then the guard can do as he thinks best. But if they look no worse than their cohort, then they would be able to continue with this diet. I think it is very important to note that this is not an outright refusal to eat the king's food. Daniel thinks that it would be wrong for him to eat the king's food. And I think he's probably quite confident that it is wrong and that God will honor the test. And so he sets up the test accordingly. And he's counting on God to validate his action. But it is not a blanket refusal. He says, if we aren't healthy, then he tells the guard, you can do what you see best, think best. Verses 14 through 17. So he agreed to this proposal and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was observed that they appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations. So the guard continued to withdraw their royal rations and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. The overseer agrees to the experiment. And why does he risk it? I'm not sure why. As any government functionary knows, it is safest to follow the rules strictly. You won't get in trouble if you follow the rules strictly. But you deviate from the rules, grant exceptions, and it could all come down on your head. Ashpenaz sees it that way. He does not want to make any exceptions. He's following the rules. The guard who is under Ashpenaz, however, is willing to take the risk. I suspect he also is favorably disposed towards Daniel and his friends. And I suspect that he knows that Ashpenaz likes these men, these young men, and thinks that Ashpenaz might give him a certain measure of cover if anything goes wrong. Secondly, this is an experiment for just a short time, and the guard could call it all off if it doesn't go right. But nevertheless, the potential downside is much greater than the potential upside. So it's ultimately by the grace of God that Daniel is allowed to have this test period. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his friends seem better and fatter than the others. And God and his allowed this to happen and was thereby validating what Daniel was wanting to do and made it possible for Daniel to do what he was wanting to do. As a result, Daniel and his friends continued to receive this alternate diet. Verses 17 through 21. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams. At the end of the time that the king had set for them to be brought in, the The palace master brought them into the presence of Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them. And among them all, no one was found to compare with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they were stationed in the king's court. In every matter of wisdom and understanding, concerning which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel continued there until the first year of King Cyrus. So the four were excellent students in their program, and their achievement was another act of grace on the part of God. God gifted them to be successful in this training program, very successful. Daniel was even able to understand visions and dreams, and that becomes significant in the text as we proceed in chapters 2 and onward. The king interviewed them to assess their progress, and in his assessment, the four were the best, and they entered into the service of the king. They were better than the magicians and the conjurers of the Chaldeans. And then it says that Daniel served until the conquest of the Persians, that is, until the time of Cyrus. That's all the way to the end of the book of Daniel. So Daniel's service corresponds with the time in which the people of Judah were in exile in Babylon, and he's in service of the king, of various kings throughout that period of time. Okay, the big question in this chapter is, why didn't Daniel want to eat the food that was offered to him? It seems to me that the lack of explanation suggests that the audience would have known the critical background information. And apparently we don't have that critical background information. But I think that the book includes clues that are necessary for us to figure out the answer to this. The explanations that are typically given in the commentaries are, one, that the food was not kosher, and therefore it would have been against God's law for Daniel and his friends to eat it. That's problematic in that, as best I understand it, wine is always kosher. It's not unkosher. And wine is one of the things that he didn't want to partake of. So that doesn't seem to be the criterion that he's using to determine what he can eat and what he can't eat. The proposal by Joyce Baldwin, a commentary that's very good, I have used it quite a bit. She says that in ancient times, to eat a meal with someone implied a relationship. And that in this case, to eat meal that comes from the king implies that you have a commitment to the king. And she thinks that that's why he was unwilling to make that level of commitment to King Nebuchadnezzar. But it seems to me, if that's the case, then no official, neither Ashpenaz nor the guard, would consent to altering the diet of these boys, these young men, if that's the implication. The third thing that is offered as an explanation is that the food was sacrificed to the gods, and then that would imply devotion to the gods, and therefore Daniel couldn't do that. And it's true that vegetables were emphasized, which suggests no meat, and we know that in the ancient world, meat was often sacrificed to the gods. However, wine is also part of this. And was wine sacrificed to the gods in Babylon at this time? We have no indication of that. Maybe it is, but we don't know that. Okay, when I got to this part of Daniel in my study, I really wanted to figure out the answer to this question. If we can't figure it out, we can't figure it out. But I was hoping that I could come up with the answer to this question. And I looked at commentaries and didn't find any that I thought were satisfying. Golden Gay goes through about 10 different theories that have been proposed, but they're all along the lines of the ones that I've already suggested. But as I was studying through the rest of Daniel, and in more recent weeks, when I was looking at Daniel 10, I found what I think is a clue that's very helpful and I think can unlock the mystery. But as far as I know, I'm the only one who thinks this. So take it for what it's worth. In Daniel 10, verse 3, it says, Daniel, this is Daniel writing, I had eaten no rich food, no meat or wine had entered my mouth, and I had not anointed myself at all for the full 3 weeks. Okay, let me explain what's going on in the context. It is, Daniel has been fasting for 3 weeks, and apparently what's on his mind is, why is it that Judah is not being restored to Jerusalem? That God said there would be, and the text tells us, he'd been studying the book of Jeremiah. And in the book of Jeremiah, God said, you will be taken into exile in Babylon for 70 years. And Daniel could have calculated it's been about 70 years and it's not happening. Judah is not being restored to Jerusalem and the temple being rebuilt and all the things that God said would happen. So he's fasting. And I think we can tell from the prayer that he goes on to pray that he is lamenting the sins of Judah and asking for the restoration of Judah to its land. But his fast is not a complete fast. It's not eating any food or any drink. He's not eating rich food. No meat or wine had entered his mouth. So the fast that he's engaged in is one that precludes, that rules out meat and wine. When was he doing this? It says in the text that it's in the first month. And it's in the, like, I think it's the 24th day of the first month that God finally responds to him after he's been fasting for 3 weeks. What's going on the first month of the year? The first month of the year is when Passover happens. Preparations for Passover begin within the first 2 or 3 days of the beginning of the first month. I don't remember exactly the date. There are a whole bunch of things that have to happen before Passover, and they start in the first few days of Passover. Passover then begins on the 15th day of the month, and it lasts for 7 days. Some people say 8. So Passover would have ended just before the events that are being talked about in Daniel chapter 10 take place. And as I mentioned just briefly, much earlier, celebrating the Passover in full was a relatively recent event. And this is something that I hadn't really realized until my wife and I were reading through 2 Kings. Let me read what it says in 2 Kings 23:21. The king commanded all the people, "Keep the Passover to the Lord your God as prescribed in this book of the covenant." No such Passover had been kept since the days of the judges who ruled Israel, or during all the days of the kings of Israel, or of the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of Josiah, this Passover was kept to the Lord in Jerusalem. When I first read this, I thought, well, I thought what it was saying is Passover hadn't been celebrated at all since they had come into the land of Israel. But it says no such Passover had been celebrated. So it could be that there was some kind of celebration that happened sometimes in Israel, but no Passover that is a full-blown Passover done the way that it was prescribed, I suspect, in the book of Deuteronomy, that that had not happened. But it does happen in the 18th year of Josiah. So that's in 622 BC, just a few years, just 3 years before Daniel is born. So Daniel would have grown up celebrating the Passover, certainly during the lifetime of Josiah, and that Passover celebration may very well have continued into the time of Jehoiakim, his son. So I think that Daniel fully understood the significance of the holiday, and he understood that the holiday is a very celebratory holiday. So why is Daniel fasting and mourning? Well, the Passover, it celebrates God bringing his people out of slavery in Egypt. But now they have been taken back into slavery. They've been taken into slavery into Babylon. So what now is happening is an anti-Exodus. And as a result, he's celebrating it appropriately as an anti-celebration. That is, he's celebrating it. He's not celebrating it. He's marking it with mourning and lamentation and repentance rather than with joy. So that's what's happening in chapter 10, it seems to me. And we'll talk about that more when we get to chapter 10. Could it be that Daniel was doing this in chapter 1 as well? It seems to me it's very possible that Daniel did this every year for Passover. That what he does is celebrates an anti-Passover, or I should say, marks an anti-Passover. He had been taken captive in 605, probably in the fall of 605. He was selected shortly thereafter to be in this training program, probably within less than a year. It could very well be that this is the Passover time in the spring when the action in chapter 1 is taking place. And if that's the case, he has not been in Babylon very long. He's only been in Babylon for a few months, 3 or 4 months. I think that what's happening in chapter 1 is Daniel is in mourning as a way of marking Passover, just like he was 70 years later in chapter 10. If that's true, what would that mean for our passage? Well, it would mean that Daniel and his friends don't want to eat any celebratory food for the first 3 weeks of the month because they're lamenting the anti-Exodus that has just taken place. So they're in mourning. They're lamenting the sins of Judah that led to this result and brought them into exile. And they're praying for restoration. And Daniel wants to do that in spite of the risk that he is running. He refuses to forget the history of his people and where they are in God's plan. Even though this is in conflict with the requirements of the state. And so he's risking losing this privileged position because it is so important to him to mark the Passover in the way that he thinks is appropriate. And God allowed Daniel to find this little niche where he could continue to fully identify with the people of God and not offend the state. And that's through the God-granted goodwill of some of his captors, that that was possible. Amazing story. Very interesting. So that's what I think. That's what I think is happening in Daniel chapter 1. There are a few things that I'd like to point out in conclusion with respect to this chapter 1. The most important thing that I think we're supposed to carry out of chapter 1 is God hadn't forgotten Israel. Even though they are in exile in Babylon, even though terrible things have happened, God has not forgotten his people. And God is still totally in control of history. That has not changed. God is unconquerable. And God still cares about his people, even though they're in Babylon. And that's why this chapter is written in Hebrew. And there are hints of the end that are already there. Cyrus is mentioned at the end of the chapter. Cyrus is the one who liberates the Jews from Babylon. Golden Gay says, Nebuchadnezzar spells invasion, siege, defeat, plundering, exile. Cyrus spells the end of each of these. Nebuchadnezzar brings the day of Yahweh's abandoning his people to darkness and wrath, a historical experience and at the same time a pointer to ultimate darkness and wrath. Cyrus suggests deliverance and freedom, restoration and rebuilding, the joy of going home. It too is a historical experience, yet at the same time a pointer to the deliverance, freedom, restoration, and joy of the end. So the inclusion of Cyrus here points to the fact that there is hope. They will be released, and encouraging the reader to reflect upon that fact. And that freedom, that liberation, is hinted at in chapter 1. The second thing of significance here is we see a godly individual facing empire. And we're going to see that in several other chapters in the early part of the book of Daniel. One of the things that's a little bit surprising in that interface between empire and a godly individual is that empire is not a monolithic evil. It is interesting that Daniel does not take a purist stance. He doesn't just say, I don't want to have anything to do with Babylon, with Babylonian culture, with Babylonian religion. He takes a much more moderate stance towards those things. He takes a Babylonian name, even a name that includes the name of one of the Babylonian gods. He studies Babylonian literature and culture, including religion. That is interesting in conjunction with some advice that Jeremiah gave to the Jews who were in exile in Babylon at a little bit later date. But he wrote a letter to the people to the Jews in Babylon. And in that letter, it includes these verses. This is in Jeremiah 29:5-7. He says, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat what they produce, take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. That's surprisingly optimistic. That's surprisingly, non-puritanical with respect to Babylon and what the Jews are told to do. He doesn't tell them, isolate yourself, keep yourself completely untainted by Babylonian culture and all that sort of thing. The other thing that we see in this first chapter is there were indeed niches in the empire where Daniel could be buffered from its power. As we've seen, the palace master and the guard were both favorably disposed towards Daniel, And he took advantage of the favor that he had been granted to be able to do the things that he felt obligated to do before God, and yet still live within the system in which he had been placed. The third thing that I want to point out from this, and this is closely tied with my understanding of why Daniel would not eat the meat and drink the wine that the king had offered him, that solidarity with God and his purposes takes precedence over one's personal peace and prosperity. That's the approach that Daniel took. Daniel could have reveled in his personal good fortune. He had been taken into exile, which was his life is turned upside down, but he's been selected for this privileged program where he'll have all kinds of benefits. So in a sense, he's landed on his feet in captivity. And he could have just celebrated the fact that personally, he was in good shape. But his heart was with his people. And he realized that God was punishing his people for their sin. And as he points out in his prayer, and for his sin personally. Therefore, it is incumbent upon him to lament the sins of Israel and of him and the judgment, and to beg for God's forgiveness. And he's willing to risk his privileged position out of solidarity with his people and in recognition of what God is doing. If my understanding is right, he wouldn't have been violating a divine commandment by eating the king's food. He just thought that it was appropriate under the circumstances to mark Passover with an anti-Passover. And this was so important to him that he risked his privilege by doing that. And God honored Daniel's choice. Daniel could have died for his choice. Kings did such things. But God wanted to show his support for Daniel's stance and therefore allowed him protection that made it possible for him to do what he thought that he needed to do and yet live within the state system. Golden Gay has an interesting quote with respect to this part of Daniel. He says, "The genius and the limitation of a story of this kind is its concrete nature. As it may be impossible to move from an is to an ought, it may be impossible to move from a narrative statement to a general statement, from Yahweh enabled Daniel to triumph to Yahweh will enable us to triumph. But a concrete story describes what Yahweh has been known to do, and it opens up the possibility that he might do it again or might do something analogous." And I think that's very true and appropriate. God may not save us from a dangerous situation similar to Daniel's in the same way that he saved Daniel, but he might, he can, and he might do it in a different way. And we can take hope from that reality. Okay, that's all that I had to say. I made it through my whole outline before 6 o'clock. So I guess I'll take questions. Robbie says, given that Golden Gay says about the significance of Cyrus, do you think it is significant that in Isaiah, Cyrus is described as God's anointed, God's Messiah? Yes and no. I think that what is important about Cyrus in Daniel chapter 1 is that Cyrus is the one that ends the exile. Cyrus is the instrument through whom God makes it possible for them to go back to Jerusalem. The fact that he is God's anointed wouldn't have to be included in that picture. It is a part of that picture, but it wouldn't have to be a part of that picture. I think the critical thing is he's the one who ends the exile. So the end of exile is in sight. It is coming, it is certain, and God is doing it. Any other questions? Okay, thank you for your attention, and we'll do Daniel chapter 2 next week.